Those are our modern day economists. And modern day musicians. So yeah, you know, you just went over Phil's briefing. And it's interesting, like Phil's briefing always lays out it lays out the global situation, right? He was talking about the Middle East and LaRouche's doctrine to get us out of the Middle East. But the thing is that in the last 60 years, relatively, last 60 years, I mean, we had a revolutionary war, right, in 1776. And at that moment in the world, there was optimism. People thought that human beings meant something, that you could actually, as a human being, intervene in the universe and actually affect change. But today we're like an amnesiac society. We were born amnesiac. You know what amnesia is? Amnesia is when you knock your head and you forget everything. That's the state of the youth today. We go around and, you know, we look at statues of George Washington. We look at people like Johannes Bach and Beethoven and all these people, right? You can name 1,000, but they mean nothing. It's like looking at the tomb of the unknown soldier and saying, well, I know they fought in a war. I know they did something. But what do I know about this person? Can I ever get inside their mind? Or can you just simply not know? And the way that I wanted to look at it tonight, and I didn't want to go into too many specifics because, you know, you can get into all this, you know, musicality and be an academic about music, but there's no point in that. The actual point is the mind. It's always the mind. So what I want to get at is the axiomatic flaws of today's music, modern music. Because modern music today is, you know, it's pseudo-music. What it is, it's been arranged in such a way through a paradigm shift in the 1960s and even before, through, you know, Richard Wagner, Liszt, after the Vienna Congress in 1815, right? Where you had a shift towards Romanticism, which you actually had back then what you would call, you know, your first strategy of tension within the last 200 years, where after the Revolutionary War, you know, the British East Indian Company and the synarchists of the day decided that we need to crush the American Revolution. Crush it. Why? Why? Why would you think they want to crush, you know, our American Revolution? Where countries like Haiti became a republic afterwards. Where South America had optimism. Why? Why would they want to do such a thing like that? Hypotheses? Why? What?
Why would they want to destroy?
Yeah.
Because they were screwing up their game.
Whose game?
The British.
Sure. But think about it, right? Wouldn't everyone want a better life for everyone? I mean, Doesn't that seem like a human thing? The problem with a lot of the people, you know, the problem with the thinking of people like, you know, Milton Friedman, Dick Cheney, is they look at music like Rameau look at music. Rameau, right? Mm-hmm. Where they looked at chords, right? Just like Newton. And Newton's scum of the earth, really. Because Newton had this thing called he basically looked at two moving bodies and decided to actually, how am I going to actually coordinate these two moving bodies and actually measure their mass, right? Mass times velocity. No, I'm not supposed to. It's the Sky, can you remind me on this one? Where's Sky at? Sky's not around? Okay. Basically, I'll give you an example. What he would look at is two states in terms of gravity, two bodies attracting each other. And the way he would coordinate these things is that he would look at states, right? What he called states is in this way. he would say, all right, you have, say, a whole bunch of molecules in one state, and then the next state would have, my marker sucks, a different type, right? And then we would actually look at both of these. Well, what's the equation for the Newtonian state? Was it GM gravity?
G big M little m, or M1 M2 over.
Right. Yeah. Mass times velocity, right? And he would look at the state and try to measure the change of what's going on between these two states, right? Different amounts of molecules, different amounts of molecules in the other one. We would try to measure it, right? Kind of like what we do with statistics today. But really what we do with music. Because today we look at music in such a way where, you know, we can play a progression of chords. Does everyone know what chords are? Yeah, I mean... Right, it's just a simple triad, right? And we can take this triad and kind of, okay, well, we can move along these triads and say, all right, one triad to the next triad, and then so on and so forth, and we have just separation of these things. But what they fail to recognize is Kepler. See, Kepler has a lot to do with music. Do you know who Kepler is? He was an astronomer. And what he did through the, you know, through the philosophy of Kuza, and through the thinking of the Greeks, is that he actually discovered the ordering of the planets. And back then, I believe they only knew 6 planets. But what he did is he took the way that you would cut the surface of a sphere by, you know, say, you cut, there's only 5 ways to cut the surface of a sphere with regular polygons, equilateral polygons. You would first have a cube, then, you guys can go look at these after the class, but, you have a cube, an icosahedron, which is basically a 20-sided triangle figure with pentagons engraved, and actually making up the figure itself. An octahedron, which is made up of squares, but also has triangle faces, about 8 of them, actually 8 of them. You have your tetrahedron, which is, again, kind of a pyramid-looking figure. And then you have your dodecahedron, which just has pentagon faces on it. And then through the actual relationships that he got out of that, he looked at the sky and said, "Wow, these relationships are actually holding." And this is something that he dedicated his life to. Yeah, you guys should play around with these. You can't actually look at the. Just toss it on them.
Not a regular polygon.
That's an example of an irregular polygon. So he actually looked at this, and then what he saw was something interesting, because they actually looked at the sky, and, you know, through the Aristotelian method of, you know, certain chord progressions, we're going to actually empirically look at the chords and not the process, because the process is the most important. We're going to look at the nighttime sky, and we're going to assume these are circles. Or we're going to assume that there's loop-de-loops. Because the paradox arose to Kepler that there was Mars did a loop-de-loop. Now, you guys ever look at the nighttime sky? You're in a sphere, right? You're inside of a sphere, and you see the stars going this way. But then over the process of nights and years, we also see these wandering, what we call wandering stars, right, or planets. And we looked at this loop-de-loop and said, "God damn, what's going on up there?" See, Kepler was a real human being, but the way that I mean real human being, I mean the normality of human beings. Something that Jonathan Tenenbaum, one of our local geniuses in Europe, he said that the normality of human beings is genius. If you're not a genius, you're not normal. You're acting against your own nature. And really, I mean, that's the end of you. If you act against your own nature, you cease to be. Kind of like a dog who's pessimistic. Think about it. Right? Dog who's pessimistic, crossing the road, the car goes, "Ah, shit." I get it, man. Right? That's the end of the dog. Right? The universe doesn't permit. There's certain laws that you can't break. Like, you have to be optimistic. And that's what we actually have to look at the state that we're in today. We have George Bush as president, all these things, right? You can name 1,000. But we actually have to maintain optimism. And what I want to get at is the difference between a human being and an animal. Because you as a human being, believing that you're an animal, is not going to make sure that you're optimistic. Because first of all, it's a lie. And this will come up, this will become apparent after a little bit after what I go through. What LaRouche's economics really is a scientific discovery in terms of the physics that are involved in human civilization. Human civilization is a physical process, and the only way that we can look at it is in terms of physical science, just like music. We have to be rigorous about music, because there's no such thing as entertainment, unless you're just kind of like, you know, no such thing as entertainment. But I'll take an example. Like, the thing is that LaRouche's economics, coming from the standpoint of the difference between Geistesmossen and Natur Wissenschaft, it's the difference between science and art, that there is no difference between science and art, that they both involve the same type of rigor in the mind. And what I want to go through was that thing right there. Someone want to pull it over?
You want to hold it up for you
now? Oh, yeah. Maybe I should move that stereo. You want to hold it up? Who can't see?
I'm worried about the camera.
You
want
to hold? On the board? I don't know if that's gonna hold. Yeah. Who can't see? Can everyone see well? You know, I don't mind if you get up off your seats. I actually want to make this a little bit more pedagogical than anything else. But how many of you know of Jackson Pollock? I say Pollock out of disrespect. Well, today's modern world again. Just like my masterpiece that I played just now, my masterpiece, right? It doesn't involve any. That's the emotions that I was expressing. Really, I mean, that's all art and music are. At least that's what I was told. Thing is that today, I was just recently come from Washington and got a chance to visit the National Art Gallery, and they have a classical building where, I mean, it's the most beautiful thing I've ever seen, really. But then you have a sub tunnel towards the modern art building, and really, it's disgusting. I mean. I would probably walk into a manure factory and feel better about myself. But the thing is that I went through this art section. I was thinking about what effect the art itself has on society, and then what effect these pieces of art have on other pieces of art. So. It's interesting. It actually involves Riemannian mathematics in that sense then. Because how does, say, Jackson Pollock's art, right, just basically, throwing tennis balls on a canvas, or just kind of spewing whatever you want, have an effect on classical art?
See, the thing is today that we look at art in such a way, well, the first thing we say about this piece looks like a crowded marketplace. But that's it. We're so numbed by the fact that there's no reason in anything. We're so numbed at the fact that we can't find any reason at all. And then what does that, again, what effect does that have on the personal the individual? What does he have to say about, solving anything? What does he have to say about his own humanity? That there's no reason. I'm just here. But on further investigation, the East Coast has been something really interesting. Specifically one individual, David Nash, who took his own initiative and decided to look into the mind of Raphael and figure out what he was doing. What was he thinking? Why do people say this is a masterpiece? Because I don't think it's a masterpiece. It's just a piece of art. So what? What do you think Raphael is saying? Anyone? Come on, we have a room full of geniuses. Someone has to have something to say.
The difference between man and animal.
Is that what he's saying? You said the difference between man and animal, right? How do you know that? How do you know that Raphael is saying that?
Because I guess it's Aristotle and it's Plato, right?
Mm. Okay, it's interesting. She says that this is Aristotle, one of our so-called philosophers who wrote books like The Ethics and other things, and has a major influence on science and really everything in general. And then she said that this is Plato. So how do you know that?
Just because I was told.
Because you were told. A lot of so-called experts in art say a lot of things.
Plato's holding up his book, The Timaeus, and Aristotle's holding The Ethics.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. Anybody else?
I got something to say. It looks like there's a lot of philosophical activity going on in it.
What?
Garden slugs.
Garden slugs?
Yeah.
You don't see any garden slugs, right? It's true. There seems to be a lot of activity going on. Whatever this guy is doing, he's obviously talking to a group over here, right? And there seems to be a lot of discussion on ideas. Because, most people don't hold up a sphere unless it's basketball, right? And really, the only physics that they get involved, that they have involved is probably a parabola of some sort into the hoop. Yeah. I don't think it's a parabola, right? It's a... Right. So the thing is that just to be I'm gonna point out a few things and you shouldn't just go on what I say because I'm not an expert. Hooray for me! That means that you actually have to go out and try to either disprove me or prove me right. See, this is the fun of ideas, right? But we actually, this actually gets at the immortality of art. But I'm going to point out a few things. This is actually Leonardo's head. And you can know that by actually looking at Leonardo da Vinci's self-portraits. Why is Leonardo's head on top of Plato's body? Interesting. But then again, there's another quote by Leonardo. A quote. Right? Leonardo, I'm calling on your idea of John the Baptist, who's actually holding up, a cross and pointing up this way. And I'm saying, I like your idea, and I'm going to develop it in this painting to actually, make you more immortal. So I'm going to put it on Plato and Leonardo da Vinci, or Plato / Leonardo da Vinci. And then you can also know that this is actually Socrates over here. By his busts, right? You can see his snub nose, right? And he's actually having a discussion with a group of people, right? Socrates? He's actually having a discussion with a group of people. A Greek youth, it seems. A Roman soldier. Then I forget who these people are. You have a barbarian over here calling out, right?
And then you have what seemed like Dante, right? Seems like Dante. He's holding a book in the back. What's that? Well, my hypothesis that it's Dante is just through the hat and the actual, again, the face and the actual texture of the clothes. But Dante's actually standing away, but he seems to actually be having a conversation. Now, was Dante some sort of loser? he couldn't come out over to the crowd and have a discussion. But he's obviously having a discussion along this direction. Now, knowing a little bit about Dante, you can know that he's a Platonist.
Dante is an Anaxis. Why do you think Raphael would put him in school with Athens too?
What's that?
I said Dante's in the Parnassus. Why do you think that
the Parnassus is
the painting that's right next to that one in the Vatican in Rome?
It might be opposite this one.
Yes, directly opposite. I haven't done enough investigation on that, but I would actually, this is going to be part of the project into looking into history that I actually want to initiate. And again, David Nash has actually done a lot more work on the whole room itself. So I don't know. Again, this is my hypothesis that it's Dante. And the reason why that is because Dante is actually calling on the Greeks, right? Calling on a dialogue of cultures. But then, you know, you take it over here, where you have on the bottom. You know, look this up, honey. On the bottom here, you actually have the perspective being laid out of the whole painting in this chalkboard, which it seems that Archimedes' head is on it, and it's also said that it's actually Raphael's teacher. And you have Raphael behind, giving that smirk that he always does in his paintings, right? Come investigate, right? Come find out what I'm telling you.
Yeah, the very right.
Yeah, right here. This is Raphael. And go ahead, put it down. And not to actually stick to this for a while. I mean, you can do 400 years of investigation on this, which has been done. Right, this is a 400-year-old painting. But and there's also elements of the time reversal, which LaRouche actually, this idea of time reversal and the simultaneity of eternity, which is, you know, it's actually evident in here. You should do some investigation.
Can you go through the idea of time reversal a little bit?
What's that?
Can you go through that idea of time reversal a little bit?
Okay. I shall. The crab cannon, you guys have heard about the crab cannon. Oh, I should go over that later. We're going to look at this guy right here. This bearded old man who's on both sides of the painting. You should lift it up. This guy, the old guy. I'll show you a little bit later. So, you know, this bearded old guy on both sides. Who do you think that is? And I mean, you know, like I said, amnesiac culture, we really can't call on too many names, right? But so most of us have been around at least a year. So I'm sure we can name a couple hypotheses, right? Like who it would be.
Mm-hmm. Moses?
How do you know?
I'm just guessing.
Must be Moses, right? that's something that I was asking. I was like, why isn't Nicholas accused of it? But I mean, you know, if you actually look at it, all the people that he's promoting in this painting, he's saying are great. That, you know, they all studied Cusa. Well, most of them, not all of them, actually. But they're all influenced by the Cusa in school. I'm going to get to that. So, this guy right here, I should be posing a lot more paradox, but I want to move on. You have these three, you know, three young people in a progression of into an older person. Right? In which this old guy is actually walking this way. and then seemingly walking this way again, right?
So it's like Father Time.
Right. At least that's what my hypothesis is.
What? So I was thinking first one.
Maybe it's Father Time is what I said.
But again, my hypothesis is Father Time. Because of the evidence portrayed here, and you know, a lot of the so-called experts can't name who these people are. Some people say it's Joan of Arc, others just don't even name the person. But you get in this idea of composition that out of everything that's going on here, what I've laid out to you is just certain anomalies that actually uplift this idea of a dialogue, motions going on among motions. Right? Just like, kind of like the Requiem, where you have several canons, right? Several lines of music that are being layered on top of each other over a span of time. And then inverted, Bach inverts, flips around, mirrors, plays, he plays with this stuff. But the idea of these motions actually overlaying, that this is an actual composition. But then we have a huge paradox, which most artists will always schooled artists, competent artists, always find this guy intriguing. Who is this guy? How do we know who he is? How can we prove that this is who Raphael intended to be there? How do we know? Are we just existentialists and say we can't?
What? I was just confused. I thought Leonardo da Vinci made this painting.
No, it was Raphael.
It's
Raphael. Yeah. He loved Leonardo da Vinci, though. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
It's obvious by the fact that he put him on Plato.
Yeah.
Right? But, you have this guy with, interesting, there's a quote by Leonardo da Vinci that says, "Don't draw your muscles like a bag of peanuts." Right? And you can tell that this guy's got some voluptuous knees. My God. Look at the knees on him. But here's the thing, is that this guy's actually out of the perspective. He the cylinder block seems to be pushed into the stairway, and he's not even sitting on anything. He's kind of like floating up in the air. Right?
Yeah.
And then you have his clothes, sculptor's clothes. You can tell by looking at the actual fashion design. This is for Vicky.
Yeah.
I need one, okay? Right here. Yeah. Size 5. You actually have a marble stone, marble block, and you know that Michelangelo sculpted the statue of David. He was a sculptor. But the most interesting part, right? Is why is he writing? If you actually look into Michelangelo's poetry, what do you find? Come on, paper. Yeah, I'm serious. A total romantic. Yeah, basically, it's kind of like what we hear with Nelly, right? I can't quote Nelly. I refuse to. But Michelangelo, right? I love your boobs or something like that. But this is again. This figure itself is actually a quote of Michelangelo's Sixtine Chapel, where you have a figure sitting exactly the same way. And I forget the guy's actual name, which I was looking at. I didn't get a chance to call the East Coast to confirm it who it was, but. There's an obvious intention, because why is he out of the perspective? Right, he was supposedly a follower of Leonardo da Vinci's school of thought and art. Why is that a polemic against? I mean, is it a polemic against Michelangelo? Again, the way that we actually know is through hypothesizing and testing our hypothesis against this piece of art. And the best piece of art is actually those pieces of art that throw you into the drama that is going in place. You notice that the actual perspective throws you into the drama. What school of thought are you? Aristotelian or Platonist? Something to look at, something to investigate. And like I said, this is something that I'm proposing to actually, right now, this is my proposal right now, that we need to actually go through a rigorous study of this stuff throughout the academics, our organization really, I mean, by the way that we think through LaRouche's economics, we're more competent on everything else than anyone else. I'm serious. And it's not an egotistical statement, it's what I've come to find out for the last year. That, and again, I'll elaborate that a little bit later too. But I wanna actually use this, art and even music as a window into history, as a pedagogical into history, and take it out in the field. See what they're doing out on the East Coast. There's David Nash fellow, right? Nance. I forget his last name. I just call him David. He's been bringing up classical art, and what it seems to me is, taking out Bruegel, right? The blind leading the blind, taking out Raphael, and forcing him to actually deploy with us, right? Not really forcing them. We don't have to force them. We just take a piece of art with them, right? And we this actually pulls people to the table. What is that, right? This is what I experienced in Washington. People actually come up to the table and go, "Who's that?" Right? Can someone turn off the light? I couldn't find any transparencies. So we'll see if I can deal. Let's see. You gotta turn off another light.
Grab a stack of literature.
Yeah, that'll be better. You wanna grab a stack? And also, what do you guys think about pulling out Goya out to the field? Yeah, we're going to take another step. Yeah.
Two more.
Three more.
Bring new feds.
Actually, here. Let's throw this out. My tracer thing isn't working. Okay. Can you guys see this pretty well? Probably not, huh? Hold on. I should have made copies, but this one's actually better. Can you guys see this?
Somewhat.
I'll actually stand a little bit closer. What you're seeing there? Go ahead. What you're seeing there? Is
the chicken gas poke?
Pass it along a little bit quicker, please. Not to be rude or anything. I just gotta. We should stay with you guys all night.
You just start talking about it.
What you actually see is a group of flying birds with people's heads on them, and the fallacy of Goya is that he's supposedly a surrealist, which is absurd if you actually look at his paintings and again rigorously go through them. But you have a whole bunch of birds flying around, a ladybird, right, on top of a tree, and they're all flying around him, and underneath this tree you have a whole bunch of wicked women taking one of these birds and probing a featherless It's probing this featherless bird with a person's head on it with a branding type tool, so it's burned. That's a typical collapse function. No, seriously, look at it. That's Goya's triple curve. And Alex from Washington D.C. he got me interested in that.
Was this by?
Goya. And the thing is that what most people don't realize is that if you're going to be an artist of any sort, you have to be an economist. You actually have to look at your society, and in such a way, how am I going to affect change in the society to actually uplift the individuals in the society? How am I going to willfully do that in the best way possible? How am I going to actually do this like Beethoven did? How am I going to actually uplift this population that has been through Napoleon? Right? How am I going to do this? What's the first idea that I have? What's the thing that you have to have? First, you have to love humanity. Second, you have to be optimistic. But not be formulaic. You have to always constantly affect change. And this piece of art always has to constantly affect you. And constantly affect civilization. And what I wanted to... I mean, you know, I'm going to quote Kepler for a second. Because, like I said, there is no difference between science and art. And this is something that should be stressed, because the way that people look at it today is not like a genius would look at it. All geniuses throughout history have looked at science and art as being exactly the same thing, as an activity of creativity from a human being that loves people. The good. Right? This is what the good expresses. Follow me, you musicians of today, and judge for yourself according to the principles of your art, which were still unknown to the ancients, to your polyphonic melodies, to your ears, and the human spirit, the beloved child of the divine creature. Nature has revealed her inner essence. The planetary motions are thus nothing else but a continuing polyphonic music perceived by the mind, not the ear. A music which progresses through dissonant tensions, as if by syncopations and cadences, as man uses these in imitation of those natural dissonances, towards certain predetermined points of contemplation. And by doing so, sets its various marks into the immeasurable expanse of time. Now, what Kepler did is he developed this idea of the planetary motions, right? And if you look at Book 3 and, you know, his harmonics, you know, the harmonies of the world, which Sky was eyeing, I was like, I couldn't get away, right? You actually look at it, and what he does is develops the idea of, you know, the well-tempered system. He says, okay, well, you know, I'm not really going to go into this, but I noticed that there are polyphonic changes inside the way that the universe works, the way that the actual ordering of this universe works. So through that, what happened later is Bach took this up through what then Leibniz did with the infinitesimal calculus. You know, the constant curvature, and then through the work of Gauss and Riemann, we as an organization have been able to determine what the precise pitch for middle C is. And this was the scientific revolution. It takes the scientific discoveries that it takes to actually have things like Bach and things like Beethoven and Mozart. But before I go into anymore that what I wanted to stress was this idea of language before I got into music, and because language is a little bit more tangible than music, it's also you don't have that much of attachment because we haven't really read any poetry as a society really, but this idea of language, communicating ideas. Why do you think that human beings actually have to communicate ideas? Why can't we just go around screwing, you know, the pigeons on the corner? Why do we have to express ideas? Hypotheses?
to increase the population density.
So that's a throw out. Right. Build on ideas, right? Just kind of like what Leonardo da Vinci and Raphael did. A dialogue among I think this is a bad idea of time, but a dialogue from distant times, right? A dialogue where you're actually saying, okay, I'm going to take up your idea and I'm going to expand on this idea. I'm going to make it better, not only for myself, but all of humanity. I will do this to actually, again, increase the relative population density. What does that mean, right? These big words, right? Scares a lot of people. It scares me sometimes. But to actually increase the living standard of your population. See, Plato had to deal with a lot of this. Plato was, again, in the school of Athens. He was a Greek. And he wrote these dialogues, the Plato dialogues, which really are dramas of a sort. And what he had to deal with was a decline of culture, the disintegration of culture inside his beloved Athens. So what he dealt with was these questions on, you know, what's justice? Right? Not the definition of justice, but what is justice? With capital J. What is the good? What is beauty? And how does a better understanding of these things, and this is what LaRouche actually calls on, how does a better understanding of these things, the ideas of justice and equality and these things, actually expand your population, make your population's living standard better? Well, a good example is, look at a barbarian culture whose notion of justice is an eye for an eye. Right? This is a good example, right? Eye for an eye? That's justice, right? Look at me the wrong way, I'll knock you out. Right? That's justice. Or is it, right? I'm not going to go into what justice is, though, tonight. This is something to think about. This is something that we should actually, after the meeting, actually have a dialogue with. Alright? Calling on what I did tonight, which is, you know, my attempt to actually communicate an idea. But this development of language, you see in Shakespeare's, you know, it's Greek to me, right? Where you actually take an example like, it's Greek to me, and you're actually calling on the ideas of what Shakespeare did, and calling on the ideas of what the Greeks did, and then expressing an idea that when you say it's Greek to me, we can then come to find out that not only are you referencing the decadence of Rome, but even the decadence of an individual in itself, right? I don't know, right? Because I haven't studied the Greeks. I don't know where I come from. George Santayana's, if you can't know where you're going without knowing where you came from, right? You have to know the past to know where you're going. But again, the idea of motion and not simple, I've been plopped here. I know the chord that I'm playing right now, but I don't know where I'm going. I don't know where I'm going after, 10 chords after that, but I know when I'll get there. I haven't really thought about this. Right? That's the way people think about music and art today. And honestly, that's the decadence of America today. Because we have such a rich culture, honestly. And, I have something. I actually wanted to do this afterwards, but I think this is a good place. Let's see. I burned these CDs in Washington, but I don't remember. Let's see. What's up here? See, this idea of as the difference between science and art. It's funny. Because Americans don't think that way. We weren't intended to think that way. We should have never thought that way. It's probably the wrong CD. Hold on. Yeah. Hold on. It's funny, you guys thought you were going to be listening to music all night tonight. Okay.
That's right.
That's
your next class?
Maybe. In a year. Let's see. This is a little lad. I hear nothing. Okay, it's not working. Mm-hmm. Well, what I was going to play for you is Ben Franklin String Quartets. But it's not working. It was working, but my CD player is killing me. I'll just show you the front cover of this. Let me pass that around. The thing is that, you know, Ben Franklin, when he was alive, he built his own cabin and painted a room blue, right? He called it the Blue Room. And in that room, he developed things like the glass harmonica, which Brendan referenced, right? He was walking out and somehow.
Yeah.
Yeah, and then then through that, you know, Mozart actually wrote a line of music, and not a line of music, but an actual piece for the glass harmonica. But he taught himself how to play the piano, the guitar, the violin, and developed his own musical instrument. And then, you know, through the work that I'm sure we've done in school and we've done here, we find out that, you know, he was a scientist, developed electricity, which we should be bringing our lighting jars out to the streets and shocking the hell out of people. Right? But, you know, the way that Ben Franklin looked at these things was through, okay, I have a certain activity, right? I'm gonna create music. Not because this is what I do for fun, but it's not because what I do this, it's not because music in and of itself, this isn't what I do on my free time for fun, but that everything I do is fun. Science is fun. Well, this is the way the sublime individual actually looks at things. That the sublime individual looks at this piece of art and actually gets the sense of immortality and realizes that that's real happiness. That I understand not only where I come from, but where I can go. So, what I wanted to get at was this notion of powers. And I think tonight is a good night to listen to the musical offering and other things. But what we actually have to do as human beings living today, as, you know, LaRouches and really, I mean, citizens of our country and citizens of the world, we actually have to expand on the ideas of our past, people of the past. But LaRouche, what he does is he develops this idea of powers and not energy. You know, some people think, there's a certain energy that's coming out of that painting, right? But there's a qualitative difference when you take a wood-burning society and, you know, juxtapose it with a oil-burning society, and you juxtapose that to a nuclear society. What are the differences? You actually have a different power. There's no way that, you know, a wood-burning society will ever have the level of a nuclear, you know, a society with nuclear energy. Impossible. Unless you want to kill a few people, right? Have them die while putting on the wood to try to get all that energy, right? So-called energy. But that there's a qualitative, there's a discovery in place. And the discovery that, you know, that Beethoven, that Mozart had was this thing that I played earlier, right? And, you know, Harley did some stuff last year, which, dissonance. And in today's music, we don't hear any dissonances, we should be here. Right? You just kind of play along. But this idea of dissonance, the Lydian mode, and you know, when you do a little bit of work on the music, I was going to go through some of this tonight, but I'm just going to call it out, and then maybe we can have a discussion afterwards. But this is actually, the Lydian mode is the golden mean between octaves. And you actually look at the spiral function and other things. But what we want to do is actually take a paradox or dissonance that we have today, which is called George Bush, and a failing economic system, you know, Goya's triple curve, right? We, the lower 80%, are being screwed by, you know, what's going on. And how would we take that dissonance and then, is this way?
The G and the...
Right? And then make that beautiful. How are we going to do that, right? So, what do you guys want to listen to? Because, you know, we can play about an hour's worth of music here.
Do you have Mozart's dissonance?
That is a dissonance quartet?
Yeah.
I was gonna try to look for that, but what I wanted to show was the idea of powers. So I think that I'm gonna.
You got John Coltrane and Horace Silver.
Who's that?
Musician.
Really?
Yes.
No, actually, what I have today is Bach, Mozart, and Beethoven.
I like
this. And. See, the thing is this idea of the Lydian mode was actually a something that had to be developed. How do I actually take cannons? Can someone sing a cannon for me? I'm going to say three people sing a cannon.
Who?
Anybody. Three people.
Any
cannon. Aaron.
Yeah.
Ami. And Edith.
In on their leader here.
John wanted to do it.
John.
John.
Any.
All right, that's it. In a Bill Steele Emma?
I don't know Bill Steele Emma.
Any of them. You know about that?
Dona nobis pacem, dona nobis pacem, dona nobis pacem, dona.
Beethoven was presented by the king of Prussia.
Bach.
Oh, but yeah, Bach. But Bach was presented by the king of Prussia Frederick the Second or the First? It was Frederick the Second, and he was presented this musical, a sort of what? Really, I mean, essentially, I wouldn't think it's a canon, but I'm not so educated on those things. But the thing is that he presented him this thing to improvise on. I mean, he improvised on this royal theme. And he developed what was, I believe was three-part theme on this. And Frederick the Great, who was actually his Bach's son, was actually working in his court. He was impressed. He said, "Oh, wow, that's nice. But can you do a six-part theme?" And Bach said, "Well, you know, I can't do that right now. It's a little hard." So he decided, okay, I'm going to take this, and I'm going to actually use this and as an organizing tool. And then he also used some jokes, right? I think it was Artifugue, right? He takes the same sorts of themes and then gives it to the king to actually make him a better king, right? I'm going to force you to actually look at this stuff and think like a human being. So Bach developed also this musical offering. And what I want to do is I'm going to play musical offering and then Beethoven and just the beginning of Mozart. You guys down? The whole Beethoven?
No, the whole musical offering.
No, it's a little long. I like it the best, though. But alright, I'll just play the Beethoven one at the end. So let's get started. You guys really gotta concentrate on this time. So what you hear is this.
What are we looking for as we're concentrating?
Listen and try to find the relationships, and I'm gonna get into some Riemann stuff at the end, just in terms of concepts, nothing too specific. I think it's fucking with me again, huh?
No, did you put?
Yeah, hold on.
Are they all
burned
CDs?
No.
We have Sky's.
That's not gonna work. Sky's computer. That's not gonna work, huh?
Well, it's working, but yeah,
it's
just
the beginning.
Yeah, try. Is it working? Okay, cool. Alright. So we want to actually listen to the dialogue that is going on. I'm going to just play the beginning part of this, and then I'm going to move on to really Mozart. I'm going to play the whole... just go ahead. Listen to this theme, and then I'm going to move on to the Mozart. This is Bach. Thank you. going to cut that off and then go to Mozart, because we could be here all night listening to music, which we should be. What's that? Yeah, that was a harpsichord chord. And he has 6 different movements to this. Movements? Is it movements? No, it's different pieces, right? How would you? What would you call them?
It's one.
Yeah, 6 parts. So you have 6 different parts with 10 different canons involved in the whole development of it. But Mozart looked at this and said, that's pretty good. But what I want to do is actually develop this dialogue a little bit more. I'm going to actually develop in terms of, you know, and what Mozart did at the end of his life, really, this idea of layering voices on top of voices, really musical painting, is very intricate, and LaRouche and everyone always stresses it. So, and actually, I can hear hints of Beethoven in this, which is. You played the Fantasia last year.
Yes.
Okay. I'll play number 10. Is it? I think it's either 10 or is it the Adagio or the Molto Allegro? 457. I think it's the Adagio.
You want to try 10 or 11?
I think it's the Molto Allegro, right?
Are you playing Beethoven?
Mozart. Play 10.
10.
Yeah. Okay. Sound familiar? Play again. We'll play until. Thank you. was wondering, did any of that amnesia kick in while you were listening to that? You guys still remember the first one? Still coherent? What did I put it? See, the thing is that in terms of music, we gotta look at it in terms of a Riemannian surface. Well, not, you know, Riemannian surface function topology, really. But also Gauss.
Is there a reason why you chose the sonata instead of the fantasy?
That was my own personal choice, because I listened to the fantasy, and I said, I wanna make this jump to Beethoven a little bit stronger. So we're gonna listen to Beethoven. Actually, what I really wanted to do is go through all of them tonight, but that's me, right? And me was like thumbs up. We can listen to the string quartets and everything too. Quote from my friend Wilhelm von Humboldt. If you guys haven't read Wilhelm von Humboldt, you gotta do it. You can borrow the back, Mike. We have now reached the point at which we recognize languages as the first necessary stage in the primitive cultivation of mankind, from whence nations are first able to pursue this higher human tendency. They grow up in similarly conditioned fashion, along with mental power, and form at the same time the animating, inspiring principle of the latter. But neither proceeds in succession, to or apart from the other, for each is utterly and inseparably the same act of the intellectual faculty, in that a people affects from its inner freedom the development of its language as the instrument of every human activity within it. It seeks and simultaneously attains to the thing itself, and that is, to something different and higher, and in that it gets on to the road of poetic creation and speculative thought. It simultaneously works back in turn upon language. If the first even raw and uncultivated attempts of intellectual endeavor are assigned to the name literature, language always takes the same road with it, and so both are inseparably tied to one another. So, look at the development that goes on. This isn't just I went at this at a limb. I used to play in a rock band and jazz and everything, and I would just I take themes, which I thought were themes. I would relate them to themes, and I thought to myself, this is a theme, right? Because I had a little bit of understanding of classical music, and I said, well, I'm gonna improvise on this theme, supposedly theme, right? Pseudo theme. And I mean, to today's standard, it was relatively good. But what was the difference in what Mozart did with this theme than what Bach did? And why is it a different power? Kind of like Henry Carey and LaRouche, or Gauss and Riemann. The problem that I always reach when I organize people, and this is specifically for the context, even ourselves, this idea is tangible in my mind because I've done the work to be able to understand certain principles of music, but more often than anything, LaRouche, what he has done is really opened the door to all human history where it wasn't tangible from before. So I could reference 1,000 names and 1,000 correlations and the musicality between all of them. But if you know these, if I reference these names and people say, well, wow, you know, he's read a lot, but I go home and I don't really care anymore. That's a problem. So what I want to express is that this idea of different powers as a qualitative change from a rigorous scientist called Mozart and Beethoven, because they looked at music as a science, not as just a simple expression of feelings. So, you guys want to listen to the whole? Yeah, I'm going to listen to the whole thing. Screw you guys. Yeah, the Opus 11. You guys want to? No. Should we? What do you? Yeah, there. Of course. You guys ready? You remember the theme, right? Beethoven's Opus 111. Miwok, can you play it?
Not right now.
Oh. Have you been drinking? Yeah, it's on 10, sorry. And I was like, wait a minute, I don't recognize that yet. It's not right. That's not the same thing. 8. 8? Yeah, 8. First one was Andreas Schiff, and this is Vladimir Ashkenazi?
Vladimir.
Yeah, Vladimir Ashkenazi. Sorry, those Russian names really kill me.
Wait, it was Andre playing the
Mozart? No, no, no. The Andre, hold on.
Oh, the Mozart.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah, see, the development of Beethoven was modes. You guys know what modes are? You guys know what modes are? Modes? Oh, Westman.
You mean like Ionian and Dorian?
Yeah, stuff like that, right? Yeah. But there's a relationship when you actually change the, there's a relationship among the keys themselves, right? That inside the scales, there's a relationship among itself. When you play, when you start off in a different place, you get a different relationship, right? Say when you start off on, so you have a regular major scale. You say, oh wow. Minor and the major. Well, the major and the minor. And what I wanted to really not conclude with really yet, but not yet, was the idea of Riemann and Gauss, and how without Beethoven, Bach, and Mozart, we wouldn't have what we have today in terms of, you know, space rockets and the internet. But really, the discoveries, like well, the real discovery, instead of all that, really, real discoveries, like understanding square root of negative one, these things, we would not be able to understand these things, or even LaRouche's economics. We wouldn't have these things if it wasn't for Bach and Beethoven and Mozart. Because what's being expressed in terms of music is you're pushing the limits of physics. You're actually experimenting in physics. What are the relationships that I can actually discover inside what's going on inside this music? And can I actually create something that's beautiful and living from physical principles that I apply to it? Physical principles like the Lydian interval, which is, yes, it is the golden mean between an octave. But how do I resolve that? How do I take a paradox of that sort and resolve it? And what Beethoven did is he said, well, look, what I'm going to do is I have a hypothesis that I can freely move from a major to a minor to a Dorian to a Pythagorean mode any which way I want. And through that, I actually have real freedom. Through discoveries, you actually have real freedom. Because like Frederick Douglass said, the only way you can keep someone a slave is if you keep them free from reason. Because if you have any drops of reason drop on this person, the slave's chains, it rusts it off, right? Sorry. But it just erodes the chains. So what I'm talking about with this notion of power, it's like what Prometheus did with humanity, bringing the idea of fire, right? Prometheus is a Greek legend, of course. He was a titan, and he went against Zeus, the tyrant. What most fundamentalists today think of God, right? He just punishes us. But he's a tyrant, like an oligarch. Today we have people like Arnold Schwarzenegger that seem to be like our Zeus, right? That he wants to knock off the Mexicans and kill the blacks, right? And he says there's a difference, there's a relationship there. But so this idea of power and freedom comes from the notion of say taking a space rocket into space. Through that, we actually achieve real freedom, because before that we couldn't do that. We couldn't go discover more about the universe. And it takes a certain amount of responsibility. Like, we can't build a rocket with two rockets on both ends and then decide to blast them off at the same time. That would just be stupid, right? At least as far as we think about things right now. But you take the idea of the fall of Icarus, right? If you don't know the fall of Icarus, basically, Icarus was a winged. Daedalus. What they did is they decided that they needed to escape from a certain amount of trouble they were in, and they decided to make wings out of wax, right? Wax and feathers, and decided to fly. And his father told him not to stray too close to the sun, because you got wax wings, right? They melt. So, just like a baby boomer, he decided to go do it. And he fell. And the population around him, in this painting, The Fall of Icarus, the peasants, weren't even looking at Icarus. Now, the theme is a little bit different in that painting. But what I wanted to express is he really didn't understand the principles of flying. And while I was out in Washington, I actually saw a picture inside the Wright Brothers Expo, which actually hit me really hard on this question of power. I saw a picture, again, of a farmer, but this time he was looking up. He saw the Wright Brothers plane. Because what the Wright Brothers did is they discovered how to fly. Not in terms of rigorously going through physical principles of how to fly, which they did. They actually did. They went through aerodynamics. So it was a rigorous example of how these two brothers figured out a universal physical principle of aerodynamics, right? It's universal. We can fly now. We have freedom. Now we can actually through that inspire what we'd call the lower peasants. But you have your Dick Cheneys who don't believe in humanity enough to be able to do that. But what I wanted to conclude with is this idea of what Benjamin Franklin would do, and what we as Americans have to do. You actually have to look at a person like Benjamin Franklin who affected change, like Riemann wanted to affect change, like Gauss wanted to affect change, through a rigorous proof of how to do it. And this is what LaRouche does all the time, like what we did with the Madrid bombings, right? We actually, LaRouche himself forecasted an event like this, like the Madrid bombs, 6 months beforehand. And we published this stuff. We were able to tell where we were going. Just like if you do a rigorous study of Beethoven, you will be able to tell where his mind is going. But in terms of economics, how do we know when we create what we do with our lives, with the talent that we have, what change will you have on the society? What change will you have in terms of the immortality of any human being or your own immortality? And what will you do to actually improve on the people that came before you and the people that will come after you? Because it's obvious that Beethoven helped out, made Mozart more valuable to us in terms of essence. So, and what are you going to do to actually save humanity? As Benjamin Franklin said, right? He said join or die. So, any questions? Come on, no one's that good. Questions?
I just walked in on the door.
That's it?
What was the last one we played?
The Opus 111 by Beethoven.
And the Mozart piece was what?
K457.
457?
Yeah.
The other one's
yeah, yeah.
Can you explain how the relationship between Bach, Mozart, and Beethoven? Can you kind of give an example of a similar relationship of that sort in the history of economics?
Sure. Leibniz, Riemann, and LaRouche. Right? One thing I forgot to go into was Bel Canto, and we should actually stick around and have everyone sing. It's not something I forgot, it's something I kind of... I did forget. I actually had it down in my notes, and I forgot to say it because this thing was covering it. But yeah, Bel Canto is a discovery that Leonardo da Vinci made, which he discovered that every human being can actually sing. It's a universal physical principle. So I was in choir, and I thought for the longest time there's just some people that don't have it, right? Some people just shouldn't even try, right? But no, what he discovered is this idea of actually placing your voice through the cavities of your face, right? Even the ugly people have this stuff, right? they have cavities inside their skull, inside their mask, what this is called. And through singing, we can actually not only have a huge-ass voice, but there's a principle in singing. I mean, you can go into further. My next class will be Bel Canto as a proof that every human being is beautiful, right? Bel Canto means beautiful singing. So, Scott?
What was the guy who was sitting there writing in the painting? And that was Michelangelo. And why was he what was the deal with him writing on that block as opposed and not sitting on anything?
Oh.
How is the relation to the rest of the thing?
To the rest of the theme?
Yeah.
Inside that painting?
Yeah, I didn't quite get that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I wanted to elaborate on this, actually. The polemic against what Aristotle is doing is intrinsically what... The reason why I didn't go through this is because everyone always points this out as the first thing. I wanted to actually get at some other stuff. But what Aristotle's doing with his knee, right?
Yeah.
And there's a quote, I forget the quote, but... Where you know, his book is actually stopping his knee from going. He's about to trip, really. But then you get at this point the correlation that you have on you know certain anomalies, which you can draw on the hypothesis afterwards. But you know, Aristotle.
I thought that was Plato with Leonardo's head.
This is Aristotle here.
Oh.
Yeah. And then you have him with his, you know, his hand on the ground instead of doing this with Leonardo da Vinci, right? They're not in unison on this idea, right? They have different ideas. You know, the one and the many, right? And whatever's here on the terrestrial, what I can see, right?
I keep him down.
Right. The horrible statue in Lincoln Park in Washington, D.C. When I become president, I'm taking this down. Is Lincoln with a slave down on the, you know, down on his fours, looking up at Lincoln, and just 20 feet ahead, just 20 feet ahead of that is a dog park, right? And this slave is actually in chains. This is a horrible place, Washington D.C. So many racist statues, like the Pike statue. You take the anomaly that the only people that are wearing shoes are here, Ptolemy, right? Another Aristotelian. Mm-hmm. A Roman, right? Another Aristotelian. Michelangelo.
You said earlier that Michelangelo had jizz on his...
Oh no! I was asking. You missed it. This is some of the problems of actually. I was asking if anybody's ever read Michelangelo's poetry.
I was gonna ask you, how did you know that he had jizz on his writing?
Oh man! Took a lot of time travel to find that one. One thing I forgot to mention was something that Dax asked me to say. I should have said it earlier. We're supposed to log in. So, is there any other questions, or can we break up the dialogue?
Well, that's the thing. Didn't he like hate the guy that he drew that? The guy that he got to that he was drawing.
Was that
Michelangelo?
Yeah, Raphael and Michelangelo were two different schools of artists. One was a Platonist and one was a Aristotelian. And if you do a further investigation in the Sixtine Chapel, take this idea of composition, right, from the standpoint of how Poe looks at it, right? You know, short. Keep it short, right? Keep it straight to the point. Very dense. This is very dense. I mean, in terms of a masterpiece, why is this such a masterpiece? As opposed to, say, Michelangelo's Sixtine Chapel, which is an immense romantic, you know, romantic heavenly bodies, right? With all the voluptuous knees you can find, right? Everyone loves voluptuous knees. But the idea being communicated up there is just, you know... How big is my painting, right? How big can I paint? How much time can I invest? How much energy can I put into this painting? Rather than what power have I affected, right? I'm sure when LaRouche was actually looking at history, first thing he turned to was probably the school of Athens in trying to determine the idea of the fight between Aristotle and Plato. And he brings this up all the time. And that's so recently though, huh? But I know an earlier 1990s paper he's brought this up several times.
I have a quick question about classical versus modern. You had said that you went to the classical museum, the most beautiful museum you ever saw, the most beautiful thing you ever saw. And you went into the modern museum, and it was like walking through. I wonder how you described it.
Well,
but I wonder what defines modern. Is there a certain period where you know that you can no longer define something as classical?
Well, it's more of an idea. This is one thing that I should have went into a little bit more was the idea that classical isn't a genre. Like, it's not like, okay, well, it's kind of like people, the way they relate to me saying that classical is the only form of real music is they say, well, it's kind of like that punk rocker that said, you know, fuck rap. No, I'm not coming from that standpoint. I'm coming from the standpoint that what I call classical is something that applies universal physical principles. And, you know, mimics nature in such a way, not what nature is itself, but mimics the processes of nature, right? The actually creating something that's alive, the relationships with the golden mean, not that is specifically, okay, well, we're going to take classical art and we're going to actually, it has to have the golden mean every single time. No, what I mean is specifically this. Is that we're taking principles that we discover in nature and we apply them to classical art or classical music. But the idea of art itself is not this painting. This isn't art. This here is not art. What you heard over the CD player, that wasn't music for singing art itself. Art, really what it is, you know, you might see these paintings here. And you might hear the music, but those are just windows for you to be able to discover what the complex domain is. It's just a window into reality, because you're getting into the realm of idea. What's the truth behind that? There's Raphael right there. He understood this, that you are going to look into my mind. And he looks at you and says, look, come into my mind. And do it quickly, so we can save civilization.
Jeremy in Oakland, he was working on LA this once, and he mentioned that in this area here, there's some type of trigonometric geometry.
Yeah, with David, he said that over here you actually have on the faces, you actually get a spiral function. That's what he told me. And then the reliefs up here, you actually have quotes of poetry and science, and perspective somehow works on that too. And the perspective itself, actually, again, this is what he told me, but again, I'm just quoting David on this. That the perspective is actually a dodecahedron. But again, I gotta call him up. And again, like I said, this actually has to be a science driver for what we do in history. As a real pedagogical, especially for us, we want to hold these holographic images of history, of the process, right? And I think the best way to do it is through art. It'll be a lot more fun, too.
Is the Opus 111, it seems like that's kind of in a spiral function.
Does it?
Yeah.
I was thinking about some of this stuff, and that's why I was looking at trying to figure out what Bach did with spiral canons. He actually has the thing called spiral canons.
Oh, really?
But yeah, we should definitely look into it. Again, we should be a lot more rigorous on this music and art stuff. That's what I wanted to come back. That's why I came back with from Washington, is this idea of how to effectively be rigorous and not get eroded down with, you know, banality or anything else, right? Yeah, well, last but I was listening to Harley's class on Beethoven and this idea of the sublime, and how, you know, I was actually I was going to talk about it, but I decided not to. It was the Schiller affecting Beethoven and the idea of the sublime, and how Beethoven actually took this, his own influence from Schiller, and actually fighting with this idea of the sublime and actually making it part of his personality, that he became that M plus one principle, that where after growing deaf, he said, I might as well almost kill myself, but then he just said, he decides not to, because he understands the importance of what he's doing, his love for art, right, his love for humanity. And that's a direct influence on Schiller. That's what he consciously is playing on, what Schiller spoke to him, right? It's great. So in the words of Poe, right, the power of words, you actually, in the ether, everything you say has an effect on everything. So only do beautiful things. All right.